From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, and it's an open phones edition of the program today, so you get to tell us about what's on your mind. We make that very easy to do. We have so many different options. They're kind of complicated to keep track of these days. Just call us. That's the easiest way. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323. Toll-free 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can share your thoughts on Charlotte blogs on the front page of wfae.org/charlotteblog. Well, the price of gasoline is literally on the tip of everybody's tongue. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's thinking about it. General Motors is thinking about it. They've cut back production of trucks and SUVs about time, while ramping up production of smaller cars. We went all through this in the 1970s, those of us who were around back then and remember. But this feeling seems to wear off as we become accustomed to a higher priced gasoline. This time, however, expensive gas appears to be here to stay, and consumers appear to be willing to do something about it as they feel the pinch. Honda rolled the first hydrogen fuel cell car off their assembly line in Japan on Monday, and a few will show up in California pretty soon. Problem with hydrogen, of course, is there's no place to put the fuel in the vehicle. There's no distribution system yet for hydrogen. There was a story on the news about this hydrogen car being available in D.C., or the prototype of it, and there was only one station in all of the entire Washington area, which is a large area, that had hydrogen available. So we have to work on that before hydrogen fuel cells will become available. The good thing about hydrogen, of course, is the waste product. The waste product of combustion is water. They don't pollute the atmosphere. I don't know what it takes, however, to make hydrogen in terms of how much energy it takes to make it, how much energy it takes to produce it, or how much pollution there might be in the production of the actual hydrogen. There may be none. I just don't know. And the other alternatives include, of course, hybrid cars and all-electric cars, the price for which promises to come down. Again, we go to California for this. I don't know why California gets all these cars first. Maybe because they have the toughest pollution laws in the country. I don't know. But there will be an all-electric car available in California later this year, priced at between $27,000 and $29,000. The only other electric car I've ever seen that is readily available cost $125,000. So this is this is an affordable car for many people. And they'll have a gas-electric hybrid of this car available for a similar price next year that they say will get 300 miles a gallon. That's right. You heard me. 300 miles. Who wouldn't buy this car? I don't care if gasoline goes to a nickel. Who wouldn't buy a car that got 300 miles to the gallon? So has the revolution begun? Would you be willing to buy a different kind of car, even if it costs more initially, or even if you get absolutely nothing for your hulking old Hummer and trade, because nobody wants it, to save money on gas in the future, to consume fewer fossil fuels, and to help us become energy independent? How high would the price of gas have to rise to make you interested in doing that? We can talk about that. We can talk about the job cuts that were announced by the Observer's parent company, McClatchy, which will include job cuts all over the country, but those also at the Observer. Newspaper business, of course, having tough times. And on the paper's own website, when these job cuts were first announced, one of the early reactions to that news from a reader, at least of the website, charlotte.com, was a posting that said, "With your people wasting money on blame America first garbage like how Guantanamo backfired on the United States, what do you expect?" That's pretty shocking, actually. It seems to me that we should all be concerned about the health of newspapers in this country, because without them, I don't know that we can run the country. The only thing we would get from the electronic media, it seemed to me, aside from NPR, would be headlines and car chases. There would be very little background or context to some of the stories that really do affect our lives, and there'd be no investigative reporting of issues like the Guantanamo, abuse of prisoners there and elsewhere. It seems to me that that's what the news media should be doing, and if we have a group of people who think otherwise, it seems to me, aren't we in more trouble than we realize already? Don't you think that's the job of the Fourth Estate, to keep tabs on the government? And if not the press, then who? We can begin there. You can pick a topic that you'd like. If you don't like those topics, that's fine. 704-926-WFAE, and we'll begin with Frank in Charlotte. Welcome, Frank.
Oh, hi. Okay, so what I would like to say is that if you were reading the Charlotte Observer, you would know that I think 500 of those people that were down there in Guantanamo Bay had nothing to do with anything.
That's right.
The only thing that they had to do is they were probably poor and couldn't read. Okay, and you would also know that this war was an illegal war, and that the kids that were dying over there, some of them were going over there for four times and are dying. Okay, and they shouldn't be dying. Okay, and somebody should be held accountable. And if you would read the paper, you would find that out. And also, you would know that our oil reserves, our gas reserves, are going up. So our gas prices should actually be going down. But speculators are causing us the gas prices to go up. And you would know, you would have something to call up your representative and ask them the reason why those things are going on. You know, so people need to read the paper, and they need. And also, you know, when you read the paper, inside there it'll tell you where you can save at when you're going out shopping for whatever you're buying. So the paper actually pays for itself, you know, and also it keeps our democracy, you know, on a steady foot ground, you know, and it just really upsets me that people would say something like that, you know, so.
Okay.
That's all I had to say.
All right, Frank, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. I agree with you 100%. John in Fort Mill, welcome to the program.
Well, hello.
Hi. Hi.
If Frank is an example of what of the positive effects of the Charlotte Observer, then I'm afraid I have to side with the other fellow.
Why?
Well, he called it an illegal war. To begin with, it was not an illegal war, as you well know, Michael.
I don't well know that, sir, so go ahead and educate me.
Well, the United Nations passed 17 or 18 or 20 or 60 sanctions against Saddam Hussein and warned him that there would be disastrous consequences if he didn't comply. He didn't, and the rest is history. Now, you can argue the rightness of the prosecution of the war, and I think that's a legitimate topic, but to call it illegal...
Well, you can also argue, as many have in the military and in other governments, including the high echelons of the British government, that if you were led into a war on charges that were false and known to be false at the time, then the war is technically illegal. And there are people who say that. I don't know if that's true, because I wasn't in on the meetings, and I don't know what people knew when they knew it. But there are people out there who believe, given the evidence presented, that there were a number of things that we alleged to be true that we knew not to be true at the time.
Well, your friend Bill Clinton alleges that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and that he should be dealt with. So if you're going to go down that road, Michael, then you're going to have to accuse Bill Clinton of dissembling as well.
I don't know who's right or who's wrong.
Then we shouldn't float those theories out there and encourage people like Frank to come out and say it was an illegal war and we're bad, Abu Ghraib, and so on. That's just silly, and it's non-productive.
So you brought up Abu Ghraib. So we were right to torture prisoners at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and elsewhere? We were right to do that?
I don't think we did torture them. And let's sort of put this into perspective. These people are terrorists. Of what Frank says, they weren't innocent peasants.
Not all of them were terrorists, and that's been proven by the United States government, that many of them were rounded up indiscriminately. They were handed over to us by warlords who had a grudge against people for things that had nothing to do with terrorism, and we let them languish there for 5 years. Is that the right thing for the United States of America to do?
Are we perfect? No. To paint us with the broad brush that we scooped up thousands of these guys is simply not true. A few, a tiny percentage, perhaps, were handed over by warlords or rival warlords, which doesn't make them Boy Scouts, by the way.
Let me ask you how you know that, because evidently we don't know anything about these prisoners. They aren't, up till recently, have not been allowed access to our legal system or even to a lawyer. So, and everything about them has been kept top secret. So how do we know anything about who these people are?
Well, I know that one of these warlords was recently prosecuted in extradited from Afghanistan and prosecuted in New York and was found guilty of exporting tons and tons of cocaine out of Afghanistan. He was no Boy Scout.
Doesn't make him a terrorist. Makes him a drug dealer.
Well, and he's going to jail for it.
Yeah. So the ends justify the means.
Sometimes, yes, they do.
Okay. I'm not sure that's American, but thank you, John, for your call. Daniel in Mooresville, welcome to the program.
Yes, good morning. I'm happy to give you the chance to talk about this. My concern is the speculation that is going on with the gas prices and nobody is doing anything about it. And secondly, I want to point out that there has been instances where the UN security has made all kinds of resolutions against other countries that has not been followed. Yet no one is going out attacking them for something that has nothing to do with 9/11. So obviously my stance is the war was illegal and it remains illegal. Okay? Saddam Hussein did all that. He never attacked America. He attacked other countries. What has that got to do with us? There are other countries that are attacking other countries and America is doing nothing. Are we going to attack all of them? You know, you can look at it from both ways, and it doesn't just make sense. We should have just pinned the Taliban down and looked for some of the land in period after 9/11. We shouldn't have gone into Iraq. We should have finished the job in Afghanistan, and we wouldn't have been where we are right now if we had done that. Thanks, and I'll take my answer out there.
Well, I don't think there's an answer to that. I don't think anybody here knows the answer to your question. I think there probably ought to be some sort of investigation, not necessarily into what we did, but into how we feel about what we did, and is this the way we want to conduct our affairs going forward? I don't think you're going to get an investigation of the past because there's no political will for it. But I think we as Americans have to decide, do we want to take what have historically been cherished principles and chuck them indiscriminately? Do we want to chuck the Geneva Convention? Do we want to put our soldiers' lives at risk if they have been captured by the enemy? If we torture, I heard this yesterday on NPR, and I forgot who said it now, somebody, I think, in the military or in the diplomatic corps. If we torture or proven to have tortured prisoners and we have people who are captured, what's to stop the enemy from doing that? If we don't follow the Geneva Conventions, why should they? And things escalate and it becomes bad for the soldiers in the field that we say we want to honor and protect and support. And if we're going to put them in harm's way by the things that we do off the battlefield with people who may or may not be guilty, then it just seems to be irresponsible and a decision we have to make, because maybe we've decided that that's the way to prosecute this so-called war on terrorism, because we're not fighting uniformed soldiers. We are fighting people who know no nation state and don't wear a uniform. Maybe it does require a different prosecution, but that's a national dialogue that we have to have and decide the answer to before we go forward, it seems to me. Got to take a break. Take more of your calls. Open phones today. Whatever your topic is on your mind is fine. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@WFAE.org. We're coming right back. Our program is made possible in part today by Dr. James Altizer and the Vein Center of Charlotte, providing state-of-the-art outpatient treatment for varicose and spider veins. Trust the vein specialist, 704-341-1122. And by Bank of Granite, now offering Granite mobile banking for cell phone access to online accounts. Bank of Granite now with state-of-the-art service as solid as our name. On the web at bankofgranite.com. Tomorrow, our guest grew up in France in a small village of 140 people, worked his way up through the haute cuisine trial by fire of European kitchens and great restaurants, and ended up as the White House pastry chef for 25 years, from the Carter administration through the current Bush administration. He'll share some of his sweet secrets with us tomorrow at 9.
Senator Obama is promising voters more progressive tax policies. Senator McCain vows to cut corporate tax rates. The plans of either candidate could add to the nation's nearly $10 trillion debt. How McCain and Obama differ on tax policies, the Diane Rehm Show, Wednesday.
That's this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
I'm Renee Montaigne, host of Morning Edition from NPR News. Before you crawl into bed tonight, rest assured that while you're sleeping, we will be watching the world. From Baghdad to your backyard and all points in between. Tune in and get prepared for the day ahead with the up-to-the-minute news, background analysis, commentary, and the latest on arts and sports. Wake up to the world with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Before we go back to the phones and share some emails on this open phones edition, I want to address the second caller who told me that if I blame the current administration for accusing Saddam Hussein of having weapons of mass destruction, then I need to blame, quote, my friend Bill Clinton, unquote. Bill Clinton is not my friend. I have met the former president. I met him while he was the president, and let me tell you, from our short interchange, he was not my friend. I was talking to Hillary Clinton and the First Lady at a concert in Washington, D.C. I somehow got myself down front during intermission and walked through the security cordon. Don't know how that happened. It just did. And found myself talking to Mrs. Clinton for quite a while. And then Bill Clinton sidled over, didn't say a word, just gave me the, who the heck are you look, which is what I would be thinking too if I were him, thinking, how did this guy get through security? And I said, nice to meet you, Mr. President, and stuck my hand out, and he reluctantly shook it and turned away. So, Bill Clinton is not my friend, to the best of my knowledge. All right, Vincent in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm good.
Some of the people that were freed from Guantanamo already have been found to have attacked American troops again when they're released. We've caught them a second time, or they've been killed. And I was wondering why that was left out when you talked about the innocent people out of
Guantanamo. Because it didn't come up. And some of those innocent people that were rounded up have become terrorists because of their experience with us, according to the reports by the McClatchy newspaper company that are being printed in the Observer.
But that means you believe what the terrorists say. I mean, they're not exactly the most honest people in the first place, are they? I mean, I'm trying to be smart, but really, I mean, they're not going to tell us, you know, come on. You believe that the news made them terrorists?
The news? No, yeah. But I believe that perhaps treatment at the hands of Americans that was gruesome and torturous may have ticked them off a little bit. What do you say to that?
What is a gruesome torture? Being in a dark room with screaming?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what we're doing because we haven't got access to
it's
that information.
It's not a gruesome torture
how
at all.
How do you know? How do you know what we're doing?
Being in a dark room with screaming.
How do you know?
What's gruesome about it?
How do you know what we're doing?
Then how does that, the paper
how
know?
Do you know what you're doing?
How does the paper know?
I don't know. I guess
I don't either, but they make it up. Because it's good press.
Well, I don't believe they make it up, sir. So there you go. Vincent, thank you for your call. Lee in Deep Cap, North Carolina. They may be wrong. They may not have all the details. They may not be able to get to the bottom of it all. They're reporting what they know. And, this business about the media being left-wing is just poppycock. Lee, welcome.
Hello there. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can.
I enjoy your show. I was struck by your reference to the electric car. And I'm extremely interested in electric cars. You know, they kind of trashed the electric car back in the 90s. They put out some really nice cars, you know, like the General Motors EV1.
Mm-hmm.
And then they leased them, and then they took them all back and refused to sell them, and then they crushed them. And so So people who really wanted an electric car, you know, couldn't even get one.
Why did they do that? Do you know?
There's a great movie called Who Killed the Electric Car, mm-hmm. which tries to explain that. And I think, I mean, the major reasons, you know, seem to be that the car companies, you know, figured out if they sold a whole lot of electric cars, then they wouldn't have this tremendous business of spare parts, you know, and they would lose money, actually, you know, because the electric cars, you know, don't have a lot of moving parts, and, you know, you don't have all the stuff to do with oil and fuel filters, oil filters, and, you know, you have the all kinds of stuff that related to oil and a lot of moving parts. So then the other thing is the oil companies would not be very happy, you know, if they had a bunch of electric cars, because then they, you know, they couldn't sell their fuel, you know, to anybody. You know, so apparently, I mean, that's one way to look at it. And the bottom line is that there were a lot of people who really liked electric cars, who basically, you know, couldn't keep them because the car companies took them back.
Well, there are three now that are coming out with electric cars.
There's
Tesla out of, I believe, Florida is producing a two-seater sports car that is already on the road, and it gets 0 to 60, I think, in 5 seconds, and it goes to 120 miles on a charge, which is not enough, really, but it's for a sports
Tesla
car.
Tesla are you talking about?
The Tesla, yeah, but it costs 100.
Tesla's 220 miles on a charge,
okay.
According to
according to their
advertising.
And then there's another one called the Aptera, which is being made in California, which is the one that's going to cost between $27,000 and $29,000. The first model is going to be all electric. The second is going to be a gasoline electric hybrid, and the gasoline component of it is not going to power the car. It's going to recharge the battery. It's going to be a generator, and it's promising 300 miles to a gallon. And I got to tell you, it's the coolest darn thing I've ever seen. It looks like an airplane without wings. It is, uh-huh. or an Indy 500 car, maybe.
Yeah, the Aptera, you're talking about.
Very cool. I would buy one like that if they were available. They're not going to be available here for years and years and years because they want to get their parts distribution and the court up to snuff. So if you have an accident, you can get a part replaced. But General Motors is promising now to produce their Volt, are they not?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, they've made promises, supposedly, and Nissan is supposed to come out with an electric car also. Which, I mean, all these things, these are interesting things, but they're, you know, it just seems like it's always, you know, a little bit off in the distance. But I think maybe the Japanese, you know, might just pop one out, you know, before anybody else, you know, in terms of the big manufacturers. You know, there are a number of small manufacturers, you know. There's another company called the Phoenix, and they're supposed to be coming out with a sport utility truck and an SUV, and they're all electric, you know, not a hybrid.
Of course, the other problem with this, it seems to me, is that if we're all going to buy electric cars, and it's not going to all happen at once, but over time, if we were to transition to electric cars and we're all going home or going to the office and plugging them in to get their batteries recharged, we're going to have to generate more electricity. And the grid that we have across the nation, we are told, is struggling to keep up with demand now. If we suddenly add everybody in America charging their cars overnight or while they're at work, what will that do to the grid? And where will the energy to produce the electricity to charge the cars come from?
Well, I mean, that's a perfectly good question, but it's been pointed out, I think, clearly that basically nighttime is, you know, that's mm-hmm. you know, slow time, you know, for electricity generation, you know, for these power plants, and that's when they have a tremendous lot of spare capacity, and there was one estimate, I'm not sure about this number, but somebody figured, I think, for California, you know, if there are a whole bunch of people, you know, going for electric cars, that at least 84% of them could be handled, you know, by the spare capacity that's available at night. You know, that's if everybody had an electric car.
You know? So would you buy one, and what would push you toward it?
Oh, I've already talked to this gentleman who is involved very much in solar electric, and he's had some experience with this, and he's going to take an older car for me and make it into an electric car, and like taking an old gas car, like a VW Rabbit.
When that happens, call us back. I'd like to talk to you about that experience.
Yeah.
Serious.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a bit of an experiment. I mean, a lot of people have done it already, you know, and there are actually kits that you can buy, you know, for this conversion process. And there are places on the web where you can go, like plug in America.
All right. Go ahead, and when it happens for you, when he delivers the car to you, I would really like to talk to you about how it operates, how much it costs you to do the conversion, and how pleased you are with the car, Lee. I'm serious about that. Please call us back. Keep tabs on us. Keep us in touch. Thanks for your call. Michael in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
I'm good.
I would like just to maybe change the subject a little bit here.
Okay.
But I'd like to talk about the energy bill, I believe it was 2006, that came out of the White House and sent up to the House of Representatives and the Senate for debate and vote. It left the White House at about $7 billion. It came back to the White House to be signed at over $14 billion. I don't know the numbers in the Senate, but in the House, all but 13 of the 435 members voted for it. So that's overwhelming. Anytime the House votes that much, you got to watch out. So it came back to the president, and as a result, I don't know the numbers again because they don't give you very much information about it, but the vast majority of that money was in tax breaks for the energy companies, the oil companies, the gas company, and the coal company. Now we have Mr. McCain and Hillary Clinton talking about, you know, reducing the taxes, and they're talking about taxes on the federal tax on a gallon of gas for the summertime. And they're also talking about taxing the windfall profits of the oil company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, number one, why on earth is this government giving the oil companies or any of the energy companies tax breaks when they make so much money? In any case, these companies make money whether gas is a dime a gallon or $10 a gallon. They make money every year anyway. So why are we subsidizing these companies when they're making fortunes of money?
Darn fine question.
And the hypocrite. I would like to know, for instance, did John McCain, Hillary Clinton, and even Barack Obama, who, you know, sensibly said that was a stupid idea, I'd like to know, did they vote for the energy bill, and did they increase it by $7 billion? They doubled it.
I'm sure that information is available on the Internet. I don't have the answer to that question, and I suppose you could pose it to the campaign of John McCain and the campaign of Obama, I think, and maybe get an answer. I just don't know the answer, but it's a darn fine question, and it's a question that needs to be asked. And we need to know what went on in the secret energy meetings that occurred between the vice president and oil company interests in the first 4 years of the Bush administration, the records of which have never been released. I don't know why those records would be secret or what's in them that would cause them to be secret. That would be interesting to find that out as well. Michael, thank you for your call. A couple of emails before we go back to the phones. Rebecca in Charlotte says one of the callers states that the Observer is liberal and that the war was legal and needs to spend more time listening to NPR. First of all, the reason the warlords are back in control in Afghanistan is because Paul Bremer handed the areas back to them. This was covered in the New York Times, the New Yorker magazine, Diane Rehm, and other NPR programs. The disaster at Guantanamo is, in fact, that. If those 500-plus innocent men picked up and sent to Gitmo were not terrorists when we picked them up and denied them due process, guess what? They are now. I don't understand this mentality of don't make me think and don't question my assumptions. And why is it that the papers and universities are considered liberal freaks? Am I the only one that sees the logical connection with education and progressive thinking? Mike in Charlotte says, just heard a caller refer to an Afghan warlord extradited for the sale of cocaine. I would imagine opium would be a more likely suspect. Wish these firebrand, my country, right or wrong zealots would stop and think. That's just my opinion. I could be wrong. Blog comment from James in Charlotte. The use of the UN by those that support this illegal war boggles one's mind. He says it's coming from those that can't stand the UN and want it abolished. We are not a UN military force. We did not invade and occupy because of any UN resolutions. If that were when do we invade and occupy other countries that are not upholding UN resolutions, i.e. Israel? It's an illegal war, not sanctioned by the UN, nor voted as to war by Congress. And if people want this country to act as though we have always condemned their actions on human rights, then stop using God to bless us. It does seem to me that we have abdicated the use of the constitutional authority to grant war or to declare war to the Congress by the Congress. Since World War II, the Congress has not declared war, and we've been to war in Korea, we've been to war in Vietnam, we've been to war in Afghanistan, we've been to war in Iraq on two occasions now, and the Congress has never declared war. I'm just curious as to why. Is a declaration of war so serious and so hefty a statement that we're afraid to do that? We'd just rather go in the dead of night? Obviously, everybody knows we're at war, so why not declare it? If the Congress believes we should be there, declare the war and get on with it and follow the Constitution. Matthew, you're on the air. Welcome.
How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. I appreciate you taking the call. I had to smile during two of the early calls because whenever somebody gets out my full first name, I'm ready for the rage under the surface.
You know? Okay.
I had to laugh. So I'm not going to call you Michael, but I did want to comment in favor of the Observer and maybe give you a little different perspective on it. But I think the key is responsible journalism. I'm a web developer. I have been for a lot of years, so I'm into the technology and all that. But how many websites do you see retractions and corrections on? You know, there's so much jive on the web that is unverifiable. And, of course, with email as well, so many people will swallow hook, line, and sinker without doing any research, where you have a paper that not only, you know, enriches our local living experience, but, I mean, is willing to say the next day, sorry, we were wrong, we were inaccurate, here's where we blew it. And if you bring it to their attention, they'll issue retractions and apologies and so on. And I think that, you know, that, along with papers, you know, I'd really rather not see as a dying breed, you know.
Yeah, and I sometimes wonder, and you're in the business of the Internet, I sometimes wonder, I understand why all these newspapers, all of them have websites,
yeah,
and all of them are free, and I understand that they're selling advertising revenue on those websites, and that's bringing income into the business, but I take a newspaper, and I have access to Charlotte.com. I'm paying for the newspaper, and I'm not paying for Charlotte.com. I wonder how long they can afford to make, particularly if the paper end of the business goes further downhill, how long can they afford to have free websites?
I know, they're a huge expense. And, of course, you know, they offset it with some advertising, but they're, you know, having their advertiser stretched between the paper and the web is going to be a stretch. So I don't know. Hmm. But on the second point real quick, in the cars, I've got a couple-year-old CRV that's very efficient. Actually, when I take it in for a smog inspection, the mechanics have to come up and tell me how the gases are almost undetectable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm nothing but excited about the electric technology. I would need this to, say, bring home plumbing fixtures for the house and things, but I would supplement it with an electric car and a New York Minute and just have both and commute with the electric car.
And how much would you be willing to pay for the electric car?
I'd be willing to pay the same amount. I paid probably $25 for the CRV loaded, mm-hmm, and I think I'd pay at least that for electric, yeah.
So I guess we're coming down to the wire here. I mean, $4 a gallon gasoline, $5 a gallon will push a lot of people over. Matthew, thank you for your call. I got to move on because I got to take a break. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by the Scheel Museum's Midsummer Festival, Saturday, June 21st, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., with a host of kids' activities, including Tonight Show veteran Tom Noddy presenting Bubble Magic, 704-866-6908. By Hendrick Lexus in Charlotte, presenting the LS. The experience is available for test drives at Hendrick Lexus, your local Lexus dealer. And by Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, serving the Charlotte region for over 25 years. We assure safety, we administer comfort. on the web at seanesthesiology.com. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Senator Barack Obama is promising voters more progressive tax policies. Senator John McCain vows to cut corporate tax rates. The plans of either candidate could add to the nation's nearly $10 trillion debt. How McCain and Obama differ on tax policies in the first hour of the Diane Rehm Show. Then, in the second hour, disaster can strike at any moment. Earthquakes, floods, terrorist attacks. An award-winning journalist explains what happens to our minds and bodies under extreme stress and how we can improve our chances of surviving a disaster. Amanda Ripley's book is called The Unthinkable, and it covers Homeland Security and risk. And she covers Homeland Security and risk for Time magazine. She joins Diane at 11. Join us now if you'd like. 704-926-WFAE, 800-603-WFAE, or Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. Back in 60 seconds.
The economy is on everyone's mind these days, and 90.7 WFAE provides the coverage you need to stay well informed.
We actually have a very affordable market nationally. We're in the sweet spot because we are not experiencing the crisis that the country is experiencing. And it is a crisis the country should experience because the market got overheated.
You can depend on WFAE for economic coverage of the issues that are important to the Charlotte region.
Some things you have to hear to believe.
We'll start with Arctic ice,
air brakes,
an albatross,
and
an autoclave.
You'll hear sounds of dentistry,
disposal of cans,
dogs speaking,
dogs howling.
As we come to the end, sea caves,
school's buzzer,
soap on
soccer.
Skin.
All sounds considered on All Things Considered from NPR News.
With regional news, weather, and traffic weekday afternoons from 4 till 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's open phones on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE at Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins, and we continue with Joe in Charlotte. You're on the radio, Joe. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. I'm a chemist, and I just wanted to give everyone a little bit of education on exactly where hydrogen comes from.
Okay.
Most people think that hydrogen is a completely green fuel, and it's true that at the point of use, there is no pollution made in a hydrogen car.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are two general ways that hydrogen can be manufactured. One of them is by combining a hydrocarbon or coal with water, heating it up, and then you get carbon dioxide and hydrogen gas out of it. And the other way is using renewable energy to do an electrochemical reaction in which you split oxygen and hydrogen apart from the water.
Okay.
So I'll let you guess as to where most of the hydrogen produced in the United States comes from, and it's not from electrolysis.
Coal.
So a lot of it comes from coal. So when you produce hydrogen, you are producing quite a bit of carbon dioxide. For every tank of hydrogen you make, I'm not sure if it's more or less. I think the hydrogen car might be more efficient in terms of carbon use.
And what happens to the carbon dioxide?
We just spew it out into the atmosphere.
And does it take? There's obviously a trade-off here. Does it take more energy to produce hydrogen fuel than it does to produce gasoline?
I would think that the gasoline is probably putting more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So I think that you do save some carbon dioxide by using hydrogen, even if the hydrogen is derived from a fossil fuel source.
And if we went to, you may not know the answer to this because you're a chemist and this is not exactly a chemistry question, but if we went to electric cars and we plugged them into the power grid every night, would we be polluting the atmosphere in the same amount that we do now with cars?
No, I think you would actually save carbon dioxide.
Okay.
Because I think a gasoline-powered vehicle is extremely inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
From an energy point of view. I think an electric vehicle uses the energy much more efficiently. You have a lot more, I would think you have a lot more heat in a gas-powered engine. I mean, because you're actually burning something in there as opposed to, you know, just working a motor.
Now they also,
I think you lose a lot more to heat in a gas-powered engine.
I also read, I don't know if this is true or not, because it was on the website for the Aptera, which is that all-electric car I talked about in California, that 90% of the energy produced by an automobile's engine is used to push the car through wind resistance. If they would aerodynamically design the cars more than they do today, some of that we would get better mileage because we wouldn't be fighting the wind.
Well, that very well could be. I'm not sure. I don't know for sure on that particular point. But
so in your mind as a chemist, is hydrogen a wise way to go?
No. And the reason for that is actually not as a chemist, but looking at it from more of a marketing perspective, Americans don't like, you know, changes, and they don't like to, you know, make huge investments in new infrastructure. So we don't have a system in place, you know, as you alluded to earlier, where you can just go to, you know, down the street and pick up a tank of hydrogen. The infrastructure doesn't exist. Mm. All these stations would need, you know, a whole mess of new tanks and new safety procedures, and you'd have to, you know, get a whole distribution network for this hydrogen throughout the entire country. So it's not a drop-in solution, which is what Americans need, I think, in order to make it successful. Hydrogen's a nice little fad, and, you know, these Hollywood stars can go buy it, and they don't know anything about chemistry, and they say, oh, look, it just produces water, and they're, you know, they can, you know, look good, and, you know. But I think what we need is something like biodiesel. We already have infrastructure for dealing with liquid fuels like that, and almost every gas station carries diesel. Mm-hmm. And biodiesel is a drop-in for regular diesel. It performs exactly the same, and it's carbon neutral.
Well, let me ask you about that, because I know that some cars, some people who have biodiesel-equipped engines can go around to places like fast food restaurants and take their old used-up grease that they've fried potatoes in, pour it into the engine, and the car runs, which is a very cool idea.
Yeah.
But if we were to go to more of a biodiesel platform, would we be seeing the same things that we're seeing now with food prices with regard to ethanol production?
Well, here's the challenge. The challenge is biodiesel can be made from almost any oil, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It can be made from waste vegetable oil. It can be made from corn oil that you get off the shelf in the grocery store. It can be made from soybean oil. And the problem is if you divert corn and soybeans to making biodiesel, you drive food prices up.
Correct.
Which, you know, really can hurt a lot of people who are economically disadvantaged, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
So the trick is to find a more efficient way to make oil. From a plant source that is not competitive with food. So, for example, there are several plants that will grow just about anywhere, and you know you can get different yields of oil out of these plants, and then use that for biodiesel production.
Is that being pursued at all?
Yes.
Okay. What are these plants?
Well, there is one plant that grows in Africa. It's called Jatropha.
Uh-huh.
And it is known as the cockroach of the plant world. This stuff will grow everywhere. And that's one
Well, is there a danger in bringing that plant to America and planting it for fuel like there was with kudzu?
Well, you know, you could always get the stuff where it grows and then ship the oil over.
What about hemp?
Convert it. I'm not sure what the yield is for oil on the hemp, but most of the time the oil comes from the seeds. So you would gather all the seeds and then you would press them, and then you would, you know, take that oil and make it.
Okay.
So, I mean, I think that's really the way. And then also, I'm a big fan of this hybrid technology with the hybrid plugins.
Okay.
So
you're not worried about what we're going to do with the batteries when they have outlived their useful life?
Well, they can be recycled in a lot of cases. I mean, the batteries. I mean, just like when you have your car battery replaced, you know, they take it and they remove the harmful chemicals. They recycle them.
Okay.
I'm entirely convinced that you can recycle a used hybrid battery, and I think they guarantee them for what, 10 years?
Something like that. Yes.
So, I mean, it's not something that I'm particularly worried about.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Joe. I appreciate
it.
I wish you'd been my chemistry teacher. I might have learned something.
All right. Have a good day.
Okay.
Bye.
A couple of emails before we go back to the phones. James in Charlotte. This is actually a blog comment. To follow up on a previous post, he says, the known torture that has taken place has killed soldiers in theater from the blowback already known as by those we occupy. If we go against our longstanding beliefs in human rights and how the teachings of our religion tell us, then we join those, as stated, we've condemned, and the result is are the retaliations that will come, and we cannot condemn, for we are doing the same. Atrocity breeds atrocity. He describes himself as a United States Navy veteran, a Vietnam in-country veteran. He said it happened in Nam. Kim in Charlotte writes, I wonder if all those who seem to want to verbally attack you would feel the same way if they were held without charges, became victims of extreme interrogations, found not to have any valuable information, and released. Many Americans, if they were in the same place as the detainees, would want the same rights that the Supreme Court ruled on. With the Patriot Act, our government can do to you, the United States citizens, what they are doing to the detainees, and we would have no recourse. And David Davidson writes, it is not the job of newspapers to blame America first, nor is it to support the administration. It is their job to report the news on all but two or three pages and allow readers to draw conclusions. Those remaining pages are devoted to their opinions and the opinions of columnists and their readers. A good newspaper invites columnists with whom they disagree and prints letters from across the spectrum. A good reader welcomes opposing viewpoints. I'm certain that most people who think that the New York Times is liberal have never read it. Same is true for those who claim that the Wall Street Journal is conservative. In each case, their editorial page is guilty as charged, but the rest of the pages are not. Have New York Times bashers ever read William Sapphire? He's also printed in the Observer, which is also described as being a liberal newspaper. Okay, back to the phones we go. And Dania in Charlotte, you're on WFAE. Welcome.
Hi, Mike.
Yes.
Hi. So I would like to say that you do a great job every day on Charlotte Talks, and I listen to it almost every day.
Thank you.
So the point that I would like to bring to today's topic is about conservation of energy, because I come from India, mm-hmm. and so I would like to tell you that I bring this perspective. I've seen that there's when I came to America, I saw that there's I'm not trying to be prejudiced or anything, but, you know, there's a lot of wastage on a regular basis that can be, conserved. And you can still, you know, do very well. I mean, you can use your appliances and everything, but, you know, people just don't have the habit of turning things off.
For instance, give me a couple of instances, some things that you saw through fresh eyes that we perhaps don't see because we've grown up doing these things.
I guess I've seen the front office that in the apartment complex that I live, mm-hmm. they never turn the lights off
okay.
when they leave the office. And also, you know, on a really good day, people just don't put up their windows and open the doors or, you know, they just turn on the AC.
Right.
And also cars, I mean, you just leave them idling all the time and, you know, there's nobody inside. I was like, why would anyone want to do that with the current oil prices? But I see that all the time.
Okay. Those would be easy things to change, it seems to me. Although a lot of people don't have screens in their windows in the South for some reason. I'm not sure why that is, but I guess because we've come to rely on air conditioning, and as soon as it gets hot enough for air conditioning, we turn it on and let it run.
True.
Tonight, for instance, it's going to be what, 59 degrees? I'll bet you nobody opens their windows.
I open my window every day. I just turn on the fan, especially yesterday night. It was so pleasant, and, you know, I didn't need the air conditioning at all. I mean, I'm not saying that you should make drastic changes,
mm-hmm.
but even if they made, like, you know, I'm just saying if Americans could just conserve the wastage, I'm telling you, we would be much better off. You wouldn't even have, I mean, even the $5 oil price would not affect you. If you could just conserve, just, you know, turn off the light. I've seen that nobody has the habit of, you know, just turning off the light when they leave the building. I mean, it just doesn't get to me that why wouldn't you want to turn off the light? And
okay.
That's how we can help the environment.
Well, thank you for your call. Maybe somebody will take your suggestion and begin to change their habits. Who knows?
I hope so.
Stranger things have happened. Thank you for listening, by the way, and thank you for your call. Let me go to Jim in Charlotte. You're on WFAE, Jim.
Hey, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Wow, you guys have covered a long a lot of ground since I thought to call.
Yeah, you've been holding for quite a while. I'm sorry.
Yeah, for a little while, but it's been real interesting. My call is about the Observer and McClatchy papers and some of the other newspapers we've heard about recently who are cutting back on staff, putting a lot of probably really good reporters out. I think it's a symptom we can pick on in a lot of other places. You see it in Wachovia, Bank of America, General Motors. Upper management manages their companies based on quarterly stock returns.
Exactly.
Stock prices. And you can't get any kind of long-term stability, long-term growth on a three-month outlook. And I see it in my business all the time. Mm-hmm. We sell equipment, and our customers go low price all the time because that's all that matters is the bottom line for that quarter.
So we're essentially long-term shooting ourselves in the foot for short-term gain.
Well, I think of it more like gnawing the foot off one bite at a time. But, yeah, I think that's a large part of our problem is we don't, in this country, we don't spend the time to look far downstream to see where we want to be. We just want to see that next quarter stock report makes management look good and makes management's pockets heavier.
How do you change that? I'm not sure you can. Can you?
If I knew, I wouldn't be where I'm at right now.
You'd be rich.
I don't know if I'd be rich, but I might be doing something different. My company just went public, and I sometimes question whether that's a very wise idea. You have a lot more freedom to manage for a long-term view if you don't have to respond to stockholders. And, unfortunately, I'm a stockholder. My retirement accounts are all in 401ks. I'm gambling in the stock market just like everybody else. So, I'm part of the problem, too. I just don't know how to fix it.
You used an interesting word when you said you're invested in the stock market. You said you're gambling in the stock market like everybody else, and that really is what it is, but no one wants to admit it.
It is. I've thought about that a lot, and it really is. It's a little more accepted form of gambling, but the difference is that in the stock market, the odds are not skewed to the house. Yeah, I mean, everybody knows, if they've paid any attention, that the guys in Vegas, and they're there because the odds are in their favor.
Okay.
Well, in our case, the odds are in the stockholders' favor, which sounds like a good thing, except that it affects how well we manage our economy.
Jim, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. I wish I knew more about the stock market, and particularly about speculation on energy prices, because we're told that a lot of the rise in the price of a barrel of oil is due to speculators who are just bidding it up hour by hour every day for the past several months. And yesterday there was news about people wrangling Congress to do something about it. I'm not sure that you can. Thank you for your calls. We're out of time. We'll do it again in the future. I'm Mike Collins.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joey Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
Charlotte Talks made possible today in part by University Volvo, featuring the C70 convertible, the S40, and the S80 sedan. As the 2008 model year comes to an end, on North Tryon Street and at UniversityVolvo.com. Volvo for life. And by Ray Ward, Creative Marketing Communications, offering advertising, public relations, interactive, media, and direct marketing services to businesses throughout the region. 704-332-9071.
Hi, it's us, Click and Clack, the Tapper Brothers.
If you're still driving a big SUV, you know that filling up that gas tank can be painful.
Yeah, your tank's only half full, and you've exceeded the limit on your credit card.
Well, we can help. Donate your old gas hog through the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program.
Your donation will help this station pay for your favorite programs, and you'll get a tax deduction.
And here's how it works.
Check out WFAE.org for details about the Car Talk Vehicle Donation Program and how you can support WFAE.
Hi, Mike Collins. Roland Mesnier grew up in a tiny French village of only 140 people. He fell in love with cooking, and that love affair took him all the way to the White House. Mesnier has been the man in charge of satisfying the presidential sweet tooth since the Carter administration. For 25 years, he made desserts for the most powerful people in the world. As a result, he had a unique behind-the-scenes view of some major happenings. He joins us to share some sweet secrets when Charlotte talks. Tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Mid-80s today and tomorrow with lots of sunshine. Upper 50s tonight. Chilly, my goodness. 76 now at 90.7 WFAE Charlotte. 90.3 WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source.
WAMU.